yourself a song to sing, and sing it till you're done. Yeah, sing it hard and sing it well. Send the robber barons straight to hell. The greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything they found, whose crimes have gone unpunished now, walk the streets a-screaming now. Greetings, all you 99 percenters. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Okay, a number of topics here of the past week of great interest. Let's begin with prices. Yeah, why are prices important? Well, because prices are an indication of problems that are coming. And they're also typically what precipitates the problem. Well, you know, when people talk about prices, they generally just talk about goods prices, goods and services. This is the consumer price index or the personal consumption expenditure PCE index that the Federal Reserve uses, or it's the GDP deflator index or wholesale prices, producer prices. There's a bunch of indexes out there. And some of them relate to the real economy, as we call it. In other words, goods and services produced. But that's not all. There are financial prices, financial assets, stocks, bonds, currencies, derivative products of various kinds. These are financial asset prices. They're important too. They're not what usually gets reported in the press or what you hear about. When you hear, oh, inflation's only 1.5%, well, that's the goods prices, goods and services. It's not really financial asset prices. And then, of course, we have prices for what we call inputs, you know, for raw materials, commodities, wages, labor input. Wages are just the price of labor. Oh, the cost of borrowing money, that's another price called interest rates. So we got all kind of prices out there. Now, the question is, do they all behave the same? Are they all just as important as the other? Not really. Well, mainstream economic theory says, oh, yes, they're all the same. They all respond to supply and demand. Similarly, you know, when a product is first offered on the market or we're coming out of a recession, well, spending increases, doesn't it? The demand for the goods or service increases the price. But over time, you know, more competitors enter the market. If it's a good growing market, they increase the supply of the goods. And when you have more supply, it lowers the price. So demand drives up the price and more supply lowers the price. And according to mainstream economic theory, over time, the initial push up from demand in the cycle will cause an increase in supply that will moderate the price increases. And if you add up all the prices of goods and services in the economy, you get the aggregate price level, and it behaves the same. It is just the sum of the parts. Now, that's mainstream economic theory. But in the real world, prices don't behave that way. You know, according to mainstream theory, the argument is prices stabilize the economy. As I just described, too much inflation adds more supply, lowers the price, stabilizes the economy. Both wings of mainstream economics, you know, the what I call hybrid Keynesians and monetarists of various ilk, they all believe the same thing, pretty much. So prices are the big stabilizer and one size fits all, meaning all prices behave this way in relationship to supply and demand. It's not true. Financial asset prices don't behave this way. Financial asset prices are largely driven by demand, and excessively so in the beginning of a cycle, a business cycle. So we see financial asset prices escalating, accelerating. That's why we get financial bubbles. Well, what drives the demand for financial asset prices? Well, it's money by those who invest in financial assets, which means the top 5%, especially the wealthiest 1% and 1/10 of 1%, those are the folks that buy the stocks and the bonds and speculate in currency and derivatives and so forth. So when they're really flush with a big increase in their income, well, they put it into the markets because the markets return more profits quicker and faster and with less risk. Because the markets, financial markets, if I'm an investor, I can get in and out of the financial market pretty quick, you know. But if I invest in Tesla's batteries or something, you know, it's pretty hard to get out of investing in real assets, as we call it, you know, companies and so forth, or building or expanding business, etc. Yeah, it's kind of hard to sell your stock of whatever product you might have or sell your company. Or sell your house, sell your apartments, whatever. Especially if there's a downturn, no one wants to buy it. Right? So, you know, it's hard to get in and out of those kinds of goods markets, but it's easy to get in and out of financial markets. So the rich folks, with all their extra money, and I'll say how much since 2008, you know, they plow it into financial markets, not just in the U.S., but now globally. Because all these new financial markets and the old are all connected by technology, instantaneous technology, talking about milliseconds, speed of light technology. So if I'm a rich investor, I can move my money around from, you know, a bond market in the U.S. to a stock market over in Asia to a currency market in Latin America and whatever. Overnight. Well, not even overnight. Instantaneously, at any time, 24/7. And that produces a lot more profit over the medium and long term. So as an investor, I like to do that. I like to invest in financial asset markets. And, you know, we've got a professional, what, class, investor class, finance capitalists, a couple hundred thousand of them or so around the globe who just move their money around. That's all they do. And, you know, they function through these hedge funds and private equity firms and finance capital firms, venture capitalists, and so forth. They're not your typical bankers. They're not Jamie Dimon, you know, of J.P. Morgan. Although Jamie Dimon and others loan those guys lots of money, too. But where do they get their money? Well, they've been getting their money, these finance capitalists who speculate in financial assets. What is speculation? It's simply, I'm buying an asset with the purpose of flipping it when its price rises. And by buying it, I increase the demand for it, which drives up the price and gives me the opportunity to flip it. So where are they getting all their income from? Well, lots of places. But primarily, you know, corporations have been giving these, quote, shareholders big bucks. As I've said before, over $1 trillion a year in stock buybacks and dividend payouts, over $1 trillion. And that's just the Fortune 500 companies. What about all the others? You know, there's billions of corporations. About 2 million corporations, about 7 or 8 million non-corporate small businesses. I'm talking about corporations who give dividend payouts of $400 or $500 billion a year in the last 10 years, well, since 2009, and even more stock buybacks. that drive up the price of stocks. Well, you give $1 trillion a year for 8-9 years, and by the way, last year was $1.4 trillion. This year it's running at $1.5 trillion in buybacks and dividend payouts. Well, what are those rich people who are getting that, the top 1 or 3%? Well, what do they do with it? Well, they don't sit on it. They don't put it under the mattress. They plow it back into these markets, these financial markets. And not just in the U.S., but because it's a global financial system now, they move it around. You know, the money flows over here to Asia and it flows over there to Europe and back and forth. And they invest massive amounts for a short period of time, which gives a nice big return. Even if the increase in the price is minimal, if you invest an awful lot of it, you know, you're still going to make a good pot of money. So it flows around everywhere. Yeah, over $1 trillion a year on average for the last 9 years, and there's no let up in this going on. Big stock buybacks, big dividend payouts. And of course, then you get the U.S. government from George Bush to Trump here, and even before under Reagan, cutting taxes on capital gains because these profits realized from financial investment are what we call capital gains. So you lower the capital gains tax rate, and you give a lot of other loopholes, which means the $1 trillion plus they get every year in this distribution from their corporations, they get to keep more of it, which means they have even more to plow into financial markets. So all this money flowing into investors, particularly the financial side, as a result of boosting financial markets, and that's going on and going on, and it's driving up financial asset prices. Now, when they move their money out of a market into another market that they move money out, that means the demand has declined, and of course, the prices will decline. And when you have a financial crash, what you have is a general pullback of investing in these financial markets. So all of these, virtually all of these financial markets decline at the same time. And seeing that there's no place else to move their money, more of it gets moved to the sideline, gets hoarded. And these financial markets begin to collapse. And that's what happened, of course, in 2008-09. Now, what I've just described to you is prices destabilizing markets. Instead of this ideology of mainstream economics, which argues prices stabilize markets, what you got is prices destabilizing markets, big time. And the most volatility, the most destabilization can be found in financial asset markets. So what goes up from this constant feeding of income into financial markets, driving up demand, driving up the price, collapses even faster than it went up when the money gets pulled out. So we have big volatility and instability in financial asset markets. And the more money that flows into financial investing, the greater the magnitude of the whole problem, and the faster the decline when it starts declining. Okay, now this isn't the whole picture, because what happens is when these financial assets and prices start plummeting, it spills over to the real economy, the non-financial economy, causes a credit crunch, and as a result, non-financial businesses can't get loans to keep going, or the price of loans they could get is too high. They'd take a loss if they borrowed it. So what do they do if they can't get the money to keep business, working capital, and investments going? Well, they cut costs. Who do they cut? Well, they cut their suppliers. They don't pay their suppliers, and then the suppliers get in trouble, and they reduce the wages and the income to their workforce by laying people off or cutting their hours or otherwise reducing wages and benefits. Well, that spills over then into the real economy when you have other small businesses and workers without sufficient income. They cut their purchase of real goods and services in turn. So the contagion spills out from financial asset markets to real goods and prices in real goods markets through that transmission mechanism. And again, it's a price mechanism, because when you cut wages, you're cutting the price of labor, aren't you? It's a price. So what drives the general price instability comes out of the financial side, but then it hits the real side of the economy, goods and services. And when those companies that produce goods and services get in a crunch and have to reduce, you know, their employment and so forth, cut their hours first, then they reduce, they lay people off, then they start cutting benefits and lowering wages itself. You know, when that happens, then those companies can't repay the loans that they borrowed from the financial markets. Oh, now we got a propagation of the process. In other words, spilling over and going from one sector to another sector. But by not being able to pay their debt, their loans, what you got is a default. So we go from price deflation in financial markets to price deflation, both in goods and inputs, wages, in non-financial markets. And that feeds back on the financial markets through the default process. In other words, non-financial companies can't pay. Well, the financial institutions holding the loans and the bonds and so forth that they bought from these non-financial companies, then they're in even worse shape. And what do? Well, they got to cut back too. They don't make loans. They cut back their employment. And what you got is a downward spiral at this point. Well, you know, this is all sort of abstract, but it's what's going on now. Let's take the case of bonds, junk bonds. Junk bonds are sometimes called high-yield bonds. These are bonds that are sold by companies that aren't doing so well, and therefore they have to pay a high interest to get somebody to buy up these bonds, you know, to get financial institutions to buy up these bonds. They got to pay a high interest. Well, also, you know, non-financial investors buy these bonds as well. Well, in the fourth quarter of last year in the U.S., the junk bond market, which is trillions of dollars, right, came to an absolute halt. They couldn't sell junk bonds, right? And the prospect of defaults loomed on the horizon. Well, that recovered a little bit here in the first quarter when the Federal Reserve started bailing out the financial and the junk bond sector by saying they weren't going to raise any rates. And now, of course, they're saying they're moving towards reducing rates. But the partial recovery in the first quarter has now slipped once again. Right? Returns on junk bonds April and May were negative. It's a harbinger of what's coming for junk bonds. All right. And there's another category called triple B bonds. That's the lowest rating for what's called investment grade bonds, which are kind of like junk. Triple B is really junk. How much of investment grade, the safe bonds, corporate bonds, are triple B? More than half. They're really, you know, de facto junk bonds. And we're talking about probably when you look at true junk bonds and you look at de facto junk bonds, BBs, you know, you probably got over $5 trillion in the U.S. alone of these very risky bonds. And then throw in what's called the leveraged loan market, which is kind of like junk loans, high interest rate loans to non-financial corporations. That's trillions as well. So there's between $5 and $10 trillion out there in junk in the U.S. alone. Now, it's junk because the companies that borrowed the money don't really have the income to pay the principal and interest. That's why they were loaned the money at a high interest rate. So what happens when those companies cannot continue to repay the principal and interest on those loans? Well, that's called a default. And as we just described, defaults are at the heart of this downward spiral. Now, you can't pay because maybe your revenues are not sufficient. In other words, you're not making enough sales. Or it could be your prices are collapsing. Either way, it reduces your revenues, right? Reduce your volume of sales, reduce your price, both of those reduce your revenues. Reduce your revenues, you don't have the cash flow in order to pay the principal and interest on your junk. Well, we got that situation. Look at the energy sector, the U.S. shale sector. Those drilling companies that have been making holes all over the place and making the U.S. the number one producer of shale or of oil in the world, over 12 million barrels a day being produced by the U.S. The U.S. is the biggest producer of oil now, bigger than Russia, bigger than Saudi Arabia. Why are they pumping so much? Well, because they got to generate the revenue to pay the principal and interest on all this junk debt that they borrowed. And if the price is falling, you got to produce even more output and make up by volume of sales to make up the loss of revenue from the price decline. And that's exactly what's happened. They're producing more and more, which increases the supply of global crude oil, and increases supply, then the price falls. So they're like, a little gerbil or whatever you call those things in a wheel, running and running, turning the wheel, you know, a little rat in a wheel. And the more they produce, the more supply drives down the price, reduces their income, the more output they got to produce drives down the price. That's the merry-go-round that they're on, U.S. shale producers. And that's why oil prices have been falling. You know, last year, they fell nearly 40%. Prices collapsed 40% as it looked like everything was slipping into another recession fast in the fourth quarter. Financial markets everywhere were in free fall, right? Until the Fed stepped in and said, okay, we won't raise prices, rates, interest rates, prices, by the way, interest rates, price of money, right? We won't raise it. And there was a little recovery in the first quarter, but now we're back on that decline. And there's been predictions that the price of West Texas crude oil is going to fall to $40 a barrel. You know, it had reached 60 about there, you know, but then it declined late last year. Then it recovered a little bit, about half of the decline of last year. So not a full recovery. And now it's heading back down. One day, last week, the decline was 4% in one day. Well, what's driving that? Well, it's the excess of U.S. oil producers and the failure of this cartel between Saudi Arabia and Russia to cut their supply in order to drive up the price. Well, this occurred last year as the global price began to collapse. Right? The Saudis and the Russians got together and, well, let's prop this price back up, right? The American shale producers are just, you know, flooding the market with oil and the price is falling. Let's cut our supply in order to put a floor under that price decline. Well, I predicted, and you can read it on my blog, jackrasmus.com, articles, that that would not hold. By the middle of this year, which we are just about at, you know, I predicted that Russia would renege and back out because Russia has to generate revenues from oil. It's very dependent on oil. Has to generate revenues in order to continue its government fiscal spending and budget. And it will do so even more when its economy slows. Well, the economy's slowing. So they're trying to increase government spending. Well, you got to have revenues for that. Well, you got to sell more oil. Well, you got to pump more oil. That means you got to break the supply agreement with Saudi Arabia. And that's what's happening. Now, I think all this intensification of the problem with Iran has to do with let's cause a crisis, drive up the price of oil. There's other factors involved, no doubt, with the U.S. picking a fight with Iran and maybe going to war with Iran. Bolton would like that. The neocons would like that. Ah, but there's a problem, you see, because both Japan and South Korea and Taiwan are significantly dependent on Iranian oil exports. That's why Prime Minister Japan Abe last week was over there in Iran and issued a statement about, let's not go to war. And all this stuff about, you know, the oil tankers being, you know, holes being blown inside a couple oil tankers this week. I don't know what that is, but boy, it sounds like the Tonkin Gulf to me. Remember the Tonkin Gulf? That was the 1960s, you know, the excuse to go to war with Vietnam, where the U.S. claimed that these patrol boats of North Vietnam attacked U.S. Destroyers, right? And that caused in the Tonkin Gulf, which is North Vietnam Gulf there. It turned out to be totally false. You know, kind of like you know, the yellow cakes that Saddam was importing from North Africa, which was proof that he was building his nuclear arms. Right? Turned out to be false. This kind of smells to me of the same thing. Secretary of State Pompeo had no explanation. Well, what do you mean Iran's at the cause of this? What do you mean? Well, no explanation. Hmm? Oh, and they show pictures about some small little Iranian boat pulled up alongside some tanker somewhere. No weapons on the boat. You know, it's just like a little patrol boat, Coast Guard boat. And it's sort of bobbing up and down right next to the big, some big tanker. Doesn't seem to be any destruction, but that's the proof that the Iranians are behind us. Now, there is a problem in the Gulf of Hormuz, and that is it's full of mines. Yeah, both sides have, you know, flooded the whole place with mines. I don't know why they're going off now, but I don't buy until there's more evidence, irrefutable visual evidence, anything that Pompeo and Bolton say about anybody anywhere in the world. These guys want a war. You know, if it's not an invasion of Venezuela, it's going to be Iran or somewhere else. You know, presidents start wars because they want to get reelected. You know, that's sometimes what occurs. So, you know, maybe that's what's going on. I don't know. But I'm skeptical. Anyway, back to global oil prices are deflating and will continue according to forecast. You know, there's two prices that set the price of global oil. One's called West Texas crude, and that's down to about 50, is going to 40 according to analysts. And then there's what's called the Brent North Sea European, It's a little richer oil, and that's about $10 above, but that will go down as well. Okay, so we see global oil price deflation, right? We see instability in bond prices. There's this global bond rally going on, rally meaning bond prices rising, government bonds, corporate bonds, as interest rates fall, right? And, of course, the Fed saying we won't raise interest rates is kind of the lead declaration that's causing other countries' central banks to lower their interest rates in anticipation of the Fed, U.S. central bank, doing the same. So we got bond prices as an indication of what's going on. Volatility in bond prices, right? Interest rate, the price of money deflating, falling, price of money falling, the price of oil and commodities falling. Stock market in the U.S. sort of marking time. Well, why is it marking time? Because whenever there is a pressure or forces to reduce prices in stocks, your institutionalists, your finance capital elite, sitting on the sideline with trillions of dollars, takes the opportunity to throw a big pot of money and catch the falling prices, stock prices, which drives them back up. You see, institutionalists, as we call it, you know, hedge funds, equity firms, that kind of thing, are responsible for 85% of all the stock trades in the U.S. It's not a small investor anymore. And they're so flush with money, trillions of dollars, sitting on the sidelines. They throw it in and they pull it out. They throw it in, the price goes up a little, capital gain, pull it out. Throw it in, pull it out. Move it here, move it there. I think that's what's keeping the stock market from a major correction, which it should have been doing by now. Okay, but it's the result of the financialization of the U.S. and global economy. All right, so the point is that this mainstream economics ideology that prices are destabilizing and one theory fits all kind of prices, whether it's financial assets or wages or money or goods and services, they all behave the same, up and down, stabilized by supply and demand. Nonsense. The most volatile is financial asset prices. And as the U.S. and global economy has become financialized, that's driving both the real economy increasingly and other forms of prices. And it's not supply and demand that drives asset prices, financial, it's mostly demand. The overexpansion, then the collapse of demand. Not a question of supply coming in to offset the financial bubbles, which is different than goods prices, you see. There, you know, to some extent, supply and demand may play a role. Supply may play a role, right? And the same thing with labor. When you got excess supply, wages will go down. And of course, in a global economy, it means you've got excess supply. So the culprit here is financial assets and bubbles and financial instability that spills over to the real economy, drags it down. And as that real economy drags down, it has a feedback effect and makes the financial side even worse, and credit dries up. And then we have recessions, big time recessions. Okay. Now, let's segue here and talk about another aspect of prices, and that's rents. Let's talk about rents and housing. Well, a report came out this week in New York City. Those of you in New York listening to this, you probably read it, right? About reestablishing some kind of rent controls. Because, of course, rents are going through the roof, aren't they? And by the way, it's these escalating, accelerating rent prices that are driving a lot of people into homelessness. Well, why are rent prices going up is the question. Well, to some extent, they're being driven up by housing prices. Oh, we know price of housing has been going through the roof, right? residential housing I'm talking about. Well, when those prices go up, landlords say, oh, well, you know, I can charge more for rents because, you know, here's these people being driven out of their houses, you know, or selling their houses, making a capital gain, and they got to have rents, so I'm going to raise the price of my rents, or, you know, I'm going to convert my apartment, my rents into condos, renovate them and sell them big time because housing prices have risen so much. By the way, the rising housing prices are not throughout the whole economy. They're mostly in certain regions and sectors of the U.S. economy. You know, the West Coast, all up and down the West Coast, including Alaska, Hawaii, and Chicago, you know, East Coast, New York, major cities in East Coast, Atlanta, places like that. You go outback Tennessee, you're not going to find that kind of escalating prices for homes. Well, then what's driving the rising price of homes is the question that then in turn pulls up apartment and rental prices. Well, in the West Coast, it's a demand that's been increasing for two reasons. One, you got the tech companies that are awarding big stock payments to its employees, and they're buying up the housing stock right and left, driving the demand, driving the price of housing up. But it's also foreign investors, you see, and foreigners coming into the U.S. from Asia in particular, bringing their money with them and buying up homes as well. Look at the West Coast, right? From Seattle to San Diego, that's the problem. A lot of Asian money flowing into buying up the demand, some of it with cash. You know, they're trying to get their money out of Asia, the millionaires over there, and they're China in particular, and money capital flight, and the money's flowing out here, and Asians like to buy property. And that's what they're doing. That combined with the tech boom and stock buybacks that I talked about in the tech industry, some of that flows down, you know, into the workforce. That's been driving up the price so much that the only building going on is really high-end homes. And that means, you know, the mid and lower end supply of homes is not, affordable homes is not being built, because the builders make more profit on high-end homes. So that's all they're building in response to this demand, both domestic tech-driven and also foreign demand for high-end housing. And high-end housing prices drag up the prices from mid-level in these regions, and that drives up, in turn, the apartment and rental prices. And that leads to landlords doing various things to make more money on their rents and apartments, right? In New York, you've had some kind of rent control for years, but they've been manipulating rent control. How? Right? Well, supposedly in New York, there's a price threshold below which the value of the property, right, they aren't exempt from the rent controls. In other words, low and medium price properties. Well, as inflation has occurred, that threshold has not been adjusted. So more and more landlords there have saying, well, you know, the value of my property is above a certain level. I can decontrol rents. I don't have to follow the rent control. There's what's called a vacancy bonus, and that is what landlords have done is increase their prices by 20% every time a tenant moves out. That was allowed under the rent controls. Well, that's an incentive to harass and drive out the renters, isn't it? So I can raise my price 20%. I can do that lots of ways. You know, I just keep turning the water on and off, or I don't repair this or that, right? And people get frustrated and they leave. And then there's also another loophole that is they can increase their price, their rents, if they renovate. Well, you know, they do some repairs and they inflate the cost of it, and then or they claim non-existing repairs and increase the price of it and get the renovation loophole. So, you know, as prices for housing in general have risen, you know, at the high end, driving up to the low end, driving up, you know, rental prices, landlords have been manipulating the vacancy loopholes and the renovation loopholes. And finally, it's led in New York, as you New Yorkers know, to this change, right, in the rent control, where they're trying to close these loopholes. Okay. Conversions, right, as well. So what does it produce with these higher rents, right, and conversions and so forth, is gentrification. Gentrification, meaning the richer folks are buying up these properties because now the renters have been driven out further and further into the hinterlands. And those that can't, a lot of them, if they lose their job or whatever, they end up homeless. Look at the West Coast. Los Angeles has over 50,000 people, I think. That's probably an underestimate, who are actually totally homeless, you know, living under highway overpasses and so forth. 50,000 people in L.A. alone. The problem's really acute, this gentrification due to rising prices. In California, there's virtually no rent control, by the way. It's not even like New York. And you got people out here can't afford a rent even. Let's take Silicon Valley, San Jose, Santa Clara Valley, Silicon Valley, right? To buy a 60-year-old small two-bedroom, one bath, little bungalow house, you know, falling apart in Sunnyvale or something like that, you're spending, $1.5 million for a little 1,200 square foot falling down 60, 70-year-old house? Yeah. Well, the rents are even worse, driven up. Workers in Silicon Valley typically commute 100 miles each way from work. They've moved out to the Central Valley or the fringes of the Bay Area, and they got to commute in, and they're all commuting in, and you know, all the freeways are clogged all the time because they can't find any affordable housing anymore because the prices have been driven up so much, and in Silicon Valley, the Bay Area, particularly driven up by the two forces I talked about, and that is techies getting big bucks, and foreigners, mostly Chinese, buying up properties. Well, everyone else in between gets squeezed. This has really happened in San Francisco. We got a gentrification going on, you know, rapidly in San Francisco and even in Oakland now in the East Bay. I heard on TV that there's a new movie going, The Last Black Man in San Francisco. Yeah. Used to have a very vibrant African-American community and Latino community. It used to be, I think the figure was 20 years ago, it was like 14% of the population in San Francisco was African-American. They lived in the poor sections of the city, Fillmore and so forth, but they've been driven out. They've been driven out. Now it's only 6%. Of San Francisco is African-American, right? And I'm sure the figures are similar for the even larger Hispanic out there in Mission District and Outer Mission and so forth. They're being driven out. Gentrification. Well, who are these people coming in? Well, they're people who work down in Silicon Valley. And the Silicon Valley, big companies, you know, Google and others, they send these big buses into San Francisco that drive around the neighborhoods picking up all their rich techies, clogging up the San Francisco neighborhoods. People can't get to work. And they drive them all the way down to Silicon Valley, 40 miles away, every day, for free. Yeah. And the techies keep plowing into San Francisco, and they keep building these high-rises now in San Francisco that are leaning. You know, big Salesforce tower here is leaning, and they don't know what to do about it. So that's driving up the – and it's happening in the East Bay now. It's happening in Seattle big time, Portland big time, Southern California. Everywhere. And folks are living now in RVs. Yeah, it's not just the homeless out on the street. Those are folks who can't find any kind of work, but they still got jobs. You know, the RVers still have jobs, but they can't afford to live in a rent. So they buy an RV and they move it around from suburban street to suburban street, and you see them all lined up on a street, maybe 40, 50 of these, and of course the locals are upset with that, all these RVers lined up on their street, and the cops come and they harass them and they just move on to another place. Yeah, RV, the RV living phenomenon. And then you've got the students who are living out of their cars at UC Berkeley, you know, 50,000 students there, University of California, and thousands of them are living in their cars? Living out of their cars because they can't afford, given the tuition, you know, and given the cost, it's mostly the cost of a rent in Berkeley, if you can find one. So gentrification is the result of accelerating home prices and accelerating apartment prices. They all go in tandem, hand in hand. And that gentrification is going on now everywhere in big cities, urban areas, it seems. And New York, of course, it reached a threshold, a pressure point, and the renters mobilized, and they're getting some changes in the rent laws. But that's not going to stop it, you see. They're going to tweak and reduce the most serious abuses of landlords, you know, vacancy conversions and so forth. And that will put a lid and slow down the increase a little bit, but it's not going to stop it. Not by a long shot. Well, what needs to be done? Well, yes, strengthen the rent controls, establish rent controls to dampen the effect. But what really is necessary is a public investment corporation designed to build affordable homes and affordable apartments. Government, yeah, public investment corporation, because the private sector won't do it. The private sector will only build high-end homes, expensive homes, because there's more profit there. Yeah. And they'll only build high-end apartments because there's more profit there. And they'll find ways to convert apartments to condos to sell as high-end apartments. That's what the private sector has been doing. That's all that they're going to do. So we need a public investment corp to do this. And we need a way to finance and fund that public investment corp. And that's going to have to be some sort of public banking system, which invests in needed infrastructure and housing and so forth without the pursuit of profit, just for the cost of the investment. Right. Well, how do you fund a public banking system? Well, how about taxing very high-end commercial property? Or taxing these builders who are making all kinds of money, or taxing the financial sector and financial taxes, right? Or how about let's put a 50% tax on all foreign money coming into the U.S. for the purpose of investing in residential structures. You know, the way it's been working, if you are a rich foreigner, mostly from Asia, you can buy your way into a permanent visa. Yeah, bring $50,000, say you're going to spend it, and the U.S. will give you a permanent visa. Well, they bring it in, they say they're going to spend it, you know, maybe they invest it somewhere, and at the same time they buy themselves a $2 million house somewhere in Silicon Valley. Why are we allowing rich folks to come in and bribe their way in with $50,000, you know, while we're doing just the opposite with poor folks trying to get in to the U.S.? I'm talking about Trump's wall. I'm talking about Central America, Latin America, and the immigration. There should be special low-interest loans for affordable housing. And if we're giving low-interest loans for folks to buy homes, well, what about renters, you know? Shouldn't we provide some kind of loan, lending to renters so they can pay the first and the last month in the security deposit, which is often required for a rent, which often is thousands and thousands of dollars? And how much can people really afford? Renters typically don't have that kind of a excess cash around. And building these affordable housing and apartments, you know, really should be driven by a special agency that will bypass all the bureaucracies and all the rules and restrictions that, you know, the builders and the property speculators like in order to keep out the competition. Okay, so there's a lot that could be done. And, you know, we're talking about rents, right? Going through the roof. I want to talk also about the latest information on the U.S. deficit and debt. Latest data came out showing that the deficit in the U.S., I'm talking about the federal government deficit, for the first 8 months is already $739 billion. That compares to last year for the same period of $532 billion. So over $200 billion more for the first 8 months, which means if it's at that same run rate for the rest of the fiscal year, it's going to be over $300 billion more than last year. Well, last year, officially, it was just under a trillion, right? According to the Congressional Budget Office. Well, that means at the rate we're going, the deficit would be $1.3 trillion this year, at least $1.2 trillion. And by the way, that doesn't count government spending on what's called black ops and black budget, you know, new technologies, new weapon systems. That doesn't show up anywhere in print anywhere in the U.S. budget annually. Only a few select congressional chairpersons know what it is, but it was estimated about 10, 12 years ago at somewhere between $50 and $70 billion a year. So it's at least $75 billion, maybe more. Well, add that to your amount last year's total deficit was well over $1 trillion. This year, if we're running at 1.2, 1.3 trillion, well, you add another $75 billion to that. So we got a deficit of well over $1 trillion now, which I've been predicting and saying would happen. And we don't even have a recession yet. We have a recession, going to go up. Spending has gone up, most of it, defense. We spend $3 trillion, and we have tax revenues of only $2.3 trillion. And, of course, those tax revenues have been shrinking, or the potential has shrunk because of corporate income tax, Trump tax cuts, undermining that. Okay, foreigners' holding of U.S. debt, you know, if you have a deficit, you got to borrow money by selling treasury bonds, right? And most of the treasury bonds now are being bought by offshore, or have been. The total holding of U.S. debt, right, went from $2 trillion just before the 2008 crash to $6 trillion today. $4 trillion more bought by foreigners in the last decade. 200% increase. $6 trillion holders of debt. Of course, cumulative deficits equal the debt. So if we're $1.3 trillion this year in deficit, you know, we've got to sell more bonds, treasury bonds. Oh, it's going to be harder to sell, though, if you start lowering your interest rates, which the Fed's going to do. And, of course, if you have a trade war with China and Japan, they're holding most of the debt, most of the treasuries. They're not going to be so inclined to buy more, you know, if we're kicking them in the face in these trade wars. No, that's one of the weapons they can use. And, in fact, China's already slowing down for 8 months now. It's purchased the treasuries. And in March, actually reduced, for the first time in a long time, its treasury purchases by $20 billion. So that's a harbinger of things to come. All right, so we got $22 trillion now in federal government debt. Corporate debt, since the recession, has gone up from $9 to $16 trillion, so $7 trillion more in corporate debt. Non-corporate debt, I'm sure, has gone up as well. State and local governments' debt is about $5 trillion. The Federal Reserve and agencies, Fannie Mae, whatever, housing $5 trillion. Household debt, $14 trillion now. $1.6 trillion for student loans. And what? Auto debt, over $1 trillion. And by the way, 7 million auto loans are in default. 7 million aren't paying their auto loans. And federal government at $22 trillion. Okay, so you're looking at 42, you're looking at over $60 trillion now in total debt in the U.S. from all sources. And Trump's tax cuts are going to add another $12 trillion over the decade. So debt's rising. Even farm debt now was an article recently escalating here in recent years from about $250 billion to now over $400 billion. Farmers are up to their ears. Students are up to their ears. Auto loans aren't being paid. Corporate debt has almost doubled. Foreigners are holding more and more of our total debt. But, you know, now the economists are saying, oh, the debt doesn't matter. Well, the magnitude may not matter, but what matters is, can you pay it? And can you pay it when your cash flow or your income declines in a recession? Your prices fall. Can you repay your debt? No. If you can't repay your debt, you default on it. If you default on it, the losses go to the institution, the bank, whatever, holding that debt. They have losses. You know, their balance sheet turns red, and they stop lending money because, you know, they got a big hole in their balance sheet, and now we're right back to 2008. And that's what's happening. And by the way, the real basket case is Europe here. And we'll talk about basket case Europe here next week. We don't really have enough time, but all kinds of indications. It's the weak man in the global capitalist economy, and it's going to get even weaker. Okay, I think that's our time up here for today. But think about prices as the destabilizing factor, right? And all kinds of prices, not one price fits all, but all different kinds of prices and how they interact. And think about rents and gentrification and homelessness, also price for the use of a property, a home, an apartment, and U.S. deficits and debt, latest figures. Okay, that's it for today. That's Alternative Visions. Streets are screaming.